Once again, take a moment to stretch up and settle in. The face goes smooth. The jaw releases. The shoulders relax, the arms are limp and loose, the legs are happy not to bear weight. And in the core, on each out-breath from beginning to end, the intercostal muscles, the diaphragm muscle, relax, release. At the same time, the spine is aligned and balanced. Find the balance point whereby you can remain upright without much efforting. The vertebrae expand to attain Father Sky. The rest of the body surrenders to the contractive force of Mother Earth. This posture is born in between yang and yin, in between expansion and contraction. Our focus range will be everything. Our focus method will be just let whatever pulls your attention do so. We'll develop concentration by briefly focusing on whatever it is. Momentary concentration, karnika samadhi. And if it's the same thing over and over again, fine. Each arising is a new turn at bat, a new chance for a home run. Home run means to have a complete experience, to completely metabolize, to make yours. To be nurtured by everything, pleasant or unpleasant, inner or outer. In terms of structure, you can do it with mental labels or just direct awareness without intentionally labeling. And you can explicitly note combinations, see here, see feel, hear feel, or just focus on one modality at a time, in which case it's just see or hear or feel. If all or part of what you're focusing on immediately or eventually disappears, gone, note that moment of vanishing. If the tug of the senses disappears, gone. Note that duration of vanishing. But there's no preference between form and formless. No preference between simple, complex, or pleasant versus unpleasant. Our ordering principle is concentration, sensory clarity and equanimity. Which could be alternatively described as our ordering principle is the attempt to have a complete experience of each thing. A complete experience is, by definition, a paradoxical one. It is optimally rich At the same time, it is minimally something. Because we're so engaged in the activity of awareness that there's no time to solidify that activity into thingness. And we return to the doingness of the primordial perfection. Our first world that we had in the first months and sometimes years of life . It's always there . Okay, AMA, ask me anything. That's also Spanish for he loves it. Yes.
We just request that everyone who asks a question speak into the mic and have it very close, as close as, let's say, a snow cone.
When I first started working in this way today, noting the categories of sensory experience, I flitted from one type of experience to another at a rather rapid pace. And I was, although it's calmed down a lot now, I was wondering whether that claiming part, maybe perhaps we should linger there longer to make a more peaceful or less fast paced.
Less frenetic.
Less frenetic.
Yes, this goes to the structure of the apparatus, and I'm a big fan of making the structure of the techniques like crystal clear so we know exactly what we're doing. So I will say that as a general principle, this kind of be aware of everything in a systematic way initially for many people does not feel like meditation. It has three characteristics. It's agitating, it's effortful, and it seems like I can't go deep. And a fourth characteristic is I'm having to think about it all the time. So I do understand that the initial experience of this may not really seem like meditation, because usually what we want is something that's restful, that's not so much efforting, and certainly that doesn't entail constantly thinking about what's going on. So I can only say that with time, all of that goes away.
It's already started to go away.
Yeah, I had the same reaction. I did this two-month retreat with Upandita, who I mentioned is the grand old man of the Mahasi. And if you've ever done a traditional Mahasi retreat, you'll know that you sit for an hour, walk for an hour, sit for an hour, walk for an hour, sit for an hour. Okay. And it's recommended that you get 4 hours sleep. So that leaves 20 hours of the rest of the day. And for that 20 hours, you are encouraged to incessantly mentally label every single thing you do. And they do everything in slow motion to make that a little easier. So my general philosophy is each form of practice has an internal consistency to it. There's a rationale behind how it's formulated. And so general principle is if you go to someone's retreat and they say meditate exactly this way, there's usually a reason for it, and I will do exactly what they say. Now, I should say, if you come to my residential retreats, I mean, I'm introducing you to this technique here, but in my longer retreats, I allow people to do any kind of meditation they want, okay? You can do anything you want. So there's no required way of working. But my philosophy is, if they say sweep the body this way, there's a reason why they set up everything to be exactly that way. So the instruction was mentally label 20 hours a day, every single thing that comes up. So by, and this is a 2-month retreat. So by the end of 1 month, oh yeah, I calculated exactly how many mental labels I made. It's easy to do the math, right? It's like how many hours times how many minutes times how many seconds I was labeling once every couple seconds. And that's a lot of labels, okay? So at the 1 month point, when I would go to bed at night, I guess I could only describe it as insanity. In my mental talk space, there was this insane chorus, like a demonic chorus, like from a B horror movie, that was parodying the labeling process. Okay, and it's like this is Looney Tunes. Okay, it had so stimulated me that there were just these, like, my mental talk space was, I could only describe it as demonic chorus, like, you know, Damien 3, you know, it's like, but the instruction was label it. Okay, so it's like, well, I would label that. Okay, label that. Just keep observing that. So that was halfway through. At the 2-month point, when I would go to bed at night, the only way I could describe it is imagine a country graveyard in winter, funereal silence, dead silence, the silence of the dead was my default mental talk space from then on. So I realized, oh, okay, there's a learning curve with this thing. And it sort of drives you crazy for a while, and then it does something very, very different from that. So in some ways, I love to introduce people to this because it gives you the possibility to be practicing in daily life. You drive your car, you have to see, hear, feel the drive. So it has that possibility, but it's a little bittersweet because I know in a day, it's probably you're just going to realize how frenetic it made you, and it didn't seem like you were meditating, and what's the point? So I just wanted to tell you that story, but you already got a little learning curve. However, getting back to my initial point about apparatus, yes, stay in, you can intentionally stay with it a little bit longer so it's not so frenetic. Furthermore, if you are using the option to label, you can relabel. You can, in fact, in traditional Mahasi, everything is labeled twice. Reaching, reaching, touching, touching, lifting, lifting. So if you're using labels, you can double label everything, triple label, quad label. That would slow everything down. What you're talking about, it would be a structure that would slow down. And of course, if you say, I'm going to triple label everything, every single event, if it I note it once, I'm going to note it 2 more times unless it disappears. That means you're going to be missing other stuff, but that's okay. Doesn't matter because you're having a samadhi or a moment of concentration on that one. And so if it's making you frenetic, you can exercise the structural option to double note, triple note, quad note, you note everything 4 times. Or if you want to really get extreme, note till gone, meaning you stay with a given experience until all or part of it disappears and you notice it. So my standard suggestion, if you find that you're flitting around a lot and it's making you frenetic, is you can intentionally double note, triple note, quad note, and so forth.
And can we add smelling as a label? Smelling?
Smell.
Smelling is another label. Besides hearing, seeing.
Well, we're going to put smell and taste under feel.
Okay.
In this system, just for simplicity.
Okay.
So the chemical senses will consider to be body events. And you, in this system, now, of course, in traditional Buddhism, they chop up the sensory experience differently. But I like to use this trimodal model because it allows for a simpler formulation, but it requires the somewhat artificial convention that smell and taste are feel, they're part of the body.
Thank you.
Yes, and we're going to do a mic situation. So way in the back.
Hi.
Yeah.
So I think I have a rather basic question. I'm just trying to think about how to even ask you it. It's attachment and relationships. And I think what I'm trying to ask is, if attachment leads to suffering in relationships, what's the point of relationships then?
Or what's the point of detachment if it gets in the way of relationships? That question could be asked either way. Okay, so did everyone hear the question? This is a very interesting question. I think that it requires a nuanced answer. So the way I like to define equanimity, I try to define, as I said, I'm trying to bring the spirit of scientific rigor into how we formulate meditation. So that means trying to be very precise about definitions for a reason. So I define equanimity as a skill, an attentional skill, and it's the ability to allow sensory experience to come and go without push and pull. Now you'll notice that, or without interference, okay? Now you notice that I said that equanimity is a relationship to sensory experience. I did not say it's a relationship to objective situations. So I think it's useful to distinguish between objective situations and sensory experience. For example, and I could give you a gazillion examples if I had time, but without loss of generality, just one example. I am sick. That's an objective situation. It's a health situation. But how do I know that I'm sick? I know that I'm sick because of having a sensory experience of fever and pain and confusion in my mind, et cetera, et cetera. So the objective situation of sickness is one thing. The sensory experience through which I know that objective situation is something else. Now, I'm going to encourage people to have the ability to experience their senses in a, quote, detached way. That's another way to think about equanimity. Meaning you're not pushing down what is uncomfortable. You're not grabbing on to what is pleasant. Neither are you pushing down on what is pleasant or grabbing on to what is uncomfortable, because actually it works the other way too. So it's this sort of hands-off attitude with regards to inner and outer see, hear, feel. But notice I said nothing about objective situations, okay? It's a relationship to sensory experience. As far as objective situations go, should I have an investment in curing my illness, or should I not care? Well, I'm going to say it's quite legitimate to have an investment in curing the disease, if I can. Should I have an investment in getting the job I want or getting the promotion I want? Sure, why not? But let's say you don't get the job you want, or you don't get the promotion, or you don't get the girlfriend or boyfriend that you want. Well, how do you know that you're not getting what you want in the objective world? Because it's a sensory experience. Your ability to have equanimity with the sensory experience of not having the job you want, that's your liberation. But that doesn't mean that you're going to be indifferent to getting the promotion, or to getting the family life you want, or to getting the person elected president you want to see president. That's an objective situation. Oh, I definitely have a preference, okay, personally. And no, I'm not going to say. And I'm sure that everyone in the United States definitely has a preference. So a lot of people are going to experience an objective situation that they don't want in just a few days. That we can say for sure. That is for sure. And something they can't do anything about, really. Should we be indifferent to who wins the election? No. We need to passionately care. Should we be able to experience any outcome without suffering? Absolutely. There's a difference between physical and emotional pain and suffering. Physical and emotional pain is part of life. It's part of the richness of life, and it motivates and directs us to act appropriately. When physical and or emotional pain is not experienced mindfully, it turns into suffering. Then it obscures the perfection of the moment, and instead of fulfilling its role to motivate and direct action, it drives and distorts action, leading to problems, bad karma. Why did I do that? Well, limbic hijack. The emotional brain got in the cockpit, and it's like you did something and you look back and you regret it. So the emotional discomfort, the rage, terror, grief, shame flavors could have been very subtle, but they, instead of motivating and directing appropriate behavior, they drove it and distorted, and then we did something that was too much or not in the right direction. So I would say that the ability to experience pleasure with deep fulfillment, physical and or emotional, and the ability to experience pain, once again, physical and or emotional, without suffering, these are very useful abilities to have. And my definition of liberation involves this and this only. My definition of liberation does not entail detachment from objective circumstances in the world. And I would claim that the degree to which you can be detached, you have the ability to be detached from the expansion and contraction of pleasure and pain in the mind and body, I would claim that the extent to which you can do that is the extent to which you will free up energy for purposeful action in the world. So, unfortunately, the Buddhist tradition does not clearly distinguish detachment from circumstances from detachment from the senses. And so over and over again within the Buddhist context, we have this confusion of, well, if I'm a good Buddhist, I shouldn't want that promotion. Or I shouldn't need a certain kind of relationship or a this or a that. Those are objective circumstances. I see nothing wrong with pushing and pulling on objective circumstances. I see nothing wrong with campaigning passionately for the person you want to see. But I would encourage everyone to become the kind of person that when things work out in the objective world, you're deeply fulfilled. And when things don't work out, you feel the pain without suffering. So I find it useful to distinguish. So I would say relationship, a passionate involvement with another person in a relationship can either be bondage or freedom, depending on your attentional skills with respect to the sensory experience of that relationship. And that's what I have to say about that. I warned everyone it was going to be a little long. Yes, blonde hair, I'm pointing, sorry.
Okay, thanks. Hi, yeah, thanks for this. There are quite a number of stimuli, maybe even the majority, that enter my awareness, but they do not direct my attention. And so I do find that when I am noting that I force them to enter my attention if I am noting them. And the other option is to simply let them exist in my awareness. I'm not sure how to approach this or whether I should be noting those things, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah,
thank you.
It somewhat depends on the technique you're doing. So there's a range of how active versus passive you can be when you do these things. So there's going to be some techniques where you would actually sort of make a systematic inventory and touch base with that stuff. But I would say just with respect to the technique we're doing today, which is only one, don't think this is like my technique. This is what I teach everyone. That's what we're doing today. With respect to this one, I would say wait for something to pull you. And if it's one of those intermediate things where you're sort of aware of it in the background, but it's not really tugging on you, consider that to be a nun and just abide in that until something is salient enough to warrant penetration. That's the structure for this particular technique.
Thank you very much.
Here, as you had one at the beginning, yeah.
I have another one. So I'm interested in your scientific definitions and your book, The Science of Enlightenment. I would love to hear your definition of enlightenment.
Yes. So first thing that, if any of you were at the thing that Lama Surya Das and I did yesterday, you're going to hear the same thing again. Because I got asked the same question. And I always answer it the same. But I'll try to give the shorter version. So first thing that comes to my mind when we bring up the E word in English, in this case it's the enlightenment word within this context, is it's just a word in English and it's going to mean different things in different contexts. So it doesn't actually have a set meaning. One person's going to use it this way, one person's going to use it that way. So if we think that there is this entity called enlightenment, then we're going to get in all sorts of unproductive discussions about things, because it's like, yes, enlightenment's real, no, enlightenment's not real, oh, this teacher has it, no, that teacher had it, they would say this, and they didn't, and this other one says that, and okay, it just goes on and on and on. So that's the situation of heat without light. So the way that you start bringing light is by saying, okay, what do we mean by enlightenment? And this is just what I mean by it, not what it means. It means whatever the hell anyone says it means, okay? So for me, it roughly corresponds within the Buddhist tradition. I'm going to say roughly. not exactly, to what in the Theravada tradition would be called sota apatti. So that means attaining the stream or stream entry. And that, I'm going to say, roughly corresponds to what in the Zen tradition would be called your first Kensho, K-E-N-S-H-O experience. Kensho in Sino-Japanese means, Ken means to see, and Sho means nature. So you've seen the nature of who you really are. Sota apatti means entering the stream, meaning from that time on, the practice carries itself, like you're in a stream now. There's no going back. And what is the salient feature of this is that there is a permanent change in your perspective with regards to the perception of what self is. It's like a paradigm shift. A paradigm shift, this is a term that's used in the history of science. It's like you look at the world one way for a long, long time, and then suddenly it's like, well, maybe the world's not that way, and then, maybe not, and it goes back and forth and back and forth, and then finally it's like, oh, yeah, guess what? The world really is this other way. That's in science called a paradigm shift. Paradigm is your basic Weltanschauung, or view of a certain area. So with respect to self, there's a standard paradigm that most people have. And it's reinforced by language constantly. And that could be called the paradigm or view that there's a thing inside me called a self that's fundamentally separate from what starts at my skin. That's the normal sort of paradigm. So another paradigm would be the earth stands still and the sun goes around it. Now that is certainly the way things appear, right? It appears as though the sun goes around the earth. You can, however, decide to look from a different point of view and say it's the other way around mostly. That's a Copernican revolution. Now, believe it or not, there is actually a lot of evidence that the earth is stable and the sun goes around it. The people that resisted the heliocentric point of view were not idiots, okay? They were scientists. They had evidence. It wasn't just belief, okay? But it turns out that their evidence was not as good as the other evidence. So eventually, a paradigm shift occurred. Now, no one really seriously says that the sun goes around the earth. The actual paradigm is they sort of go around each other. But mostly the earth goes around the sun, okay? Like, because it's so much bigger. Okay, so at one time, a lot of people believed in a stable earth. And then people didn't. And for some people, they could see that right away. Other people, it really took a while for that to sink in. So the common paradigm, what appears to be, is that the earth is stable, the sun moves. But there's a whole other way to look at it that turns out to be much more accurate and useful. But it's counterintuitive. So the normal experience of self is it's a thing, it's inside me, it came into existence at a certain time, it will die at some other time, and there's a boundary between inside and outside, between self and other. So the disappearance of that paradigm and its replacement by something else, the opposite of that, that's enlightenment in my very restricted. That's basically what happens at stream entry. That's basically what happens in your first Kensho in Zen practice. Now, having said that, that's a pretty restricted definition of enlightenment. That's a small part of why we do this practice. And I would hasten to point out that although this is often described as happening suddenly, in my experience with most of my students, it does not happen suddenly. It sort of sneaks up on them gradually over decades of practice. And yes, indeed, Every now and again, it happens dramatically and suddenly. And if you want to read descriptions of sudden, you can read the classic Three Pillars of Zen by Philip Kaplow. That's what inspired me to practice decades and decades ago, because he actually recorded testimonials of people that had done Zen practice and that it had these sudden breakthrough things. So yes, sometimes it can happen suddenly, but in my experience, often it just sort of, you acclimatize to it, but you're 20 years, 30 years into practice, and it's like, is there a thing called the self in you? Well, come to think of it, not so much anymore. Is there a fundamental boundary between inside and outside as you bop around in the world? Well, come to think of it, not really. So come to think of it, yeah, there has been a shift. And then if it happens suddenly, of course, that's really cool. And I can smell it. When they walk in the room, I can smell it. Before they open their mouth, I know they had one of the sudden versions, okay? It just has its own aura to it, okay? And that's nice if it happens suddenly, but don't think it's necessarily going to be this sudden spiritual orgasm that you've been saving up for your whole life. Okay, the other thing is, this is not the end of all your problems. This is the beginning of the solution, of the radical solution. And you still have many, many dimensions you have to work in, etc. So that's what I mean. And is that feasible? Yes, that's feasible to everyone in this room. I'm going to pass you the mic.
Okay. Since you're talking about a scientific metaphor or scientific principles to meditation, one of the first rules of science is reproducibility. That if you do the same thing exactly the same way, you get the exact same results, which is something that the Buddha, I think, said something like that at some point too. When all of us meditate trying to do the same technique and we all get different results, how does that work with the scientific method?
Yeah, that's a great question. Could you get closer to the mic and maybe say it slower?
Okay. Is that reproducibility is one of the important aspects of science. If you do the same thing in the same way, you get the same results. But all of us meditating using the same techniques, or as much as we can, we get different results. Some people, as you say, take years to get to some kind of vague enlightenment. Others get instant. How do we get different results with the same method if it's a scientific method?
So I would say that even in science, what you're actually looking at is not the same results. What you get is a bell curve, okay, that has a strong peak in the center. And in other words, most times it comes out a certain way, okay? So it's not exactly even in science that you get identical results, because there's measurement errors and all sorts of things. So you get something, you know, fairly reliable. And I would say it is also true with meditation. You just have to realize that what we're going to call result is not what happens in the first 5 years or 10 years. By result, we're going to mean the effect of a lifetime of practice. And also, by result, we're going to mean what happens if you have all the components of practice needed. If you don't have all, and I'm going to list what I consider to be the components of practice, if all four of those components are not in place, then you might not get the, quote, same results. But I would say that if a person has all four of the things I'm about to mention, and they keep up their practice for a lifetime, there is a high probability that people get pretty much the same result, which is a visage of happiness independent of conditions. So same result has to be seen in a pretty large context. The four things are a little bit of formal practice each day, a little bit of practice, informal practice during life each day, periodic retreats like what we just did here, and having at least one competent coach that you can touch base with at least once a year that is capable of guiding you through all guiding you in applying this practice eventually, not necessarily this year, but eventually, having a coach that will work with you and make sure that eventually you are applying this practice to all types and levels of happiness. And one type of happiness is knowing yourself. And there are four levels: knowing yourself psychologically, you can go to a therapist for that. Knowing yourself archetypally, you can go to a depth psychologist or a shaman for that, or do meditation. Knowing yourself as a sensory system, that's a little deeper, that's the Theravada perspective, untangle the skandhas, the inner see, hear, feel system, however you wanna chop up the pie. And then after you've untangled the strands, the sensory strands of selfhood, you'll see that all the senses are made out of the same vibrating void. Not only the inner senses of image, talk, and body emotion, but the outer senses even of that seems so solid, of touch, sight, sound. They're all made out of the same spirit essence. That's understanding yourself at the deepest possible level. That's more of a Dzogchen or a Zen formulation, although Theravada comes to it. They just don't talk about it that way. So I would say you need to have at least one coach that you touch base with on your practice that is capable of showing you how to apply your practice to all types and levels of happiness, including the deeper levels that are not intuitive at all. Pain without suffering, tiny pleasures delivering huge fulfillment, understanding yourself as a sensory system and then understanding the nature of the senses as pure spirit, improvement in objective behaviors in the world, skillful actions. It's not just about understanding and freedom from suffering, it's also about good karma. Being an admirable human in terms of what you do say and think habitually, and ultimately guiding you to a life of fulfillment from service. So if you do a little bit of formal practice each day and a little bit of informal practice peppering life, like I encouraged you to do during the lunch, and if you do periodic retreats, and you have contact with at least one competent coach, and you keep it up for your lifetime, I'm going to say you'll probably sort of get the same results somewhere along the line. But if all those elements aren't in place and you don't give it enough time, then, yeah, there's enormous, there is the variability that you allude to.
You alluded to the possibility that science, quote unquote, may facilitate at some point, you know, this path or this endeavor. Can you say something more about
that? Elaborate? Mm-hmm. Well, of course, there's a whole chapter in the book about it, but it's also fun to sort of hear it, you know, spoken. First of all, I don't claim this is going to happen. You know, the... Do you know Yogi Berra, the baseball player? Do you know who he was? So he was famous for these malaprop-isms, these weird things that he would say that sort of make sense but don't make sense. So one of the things he said was, I never make predictions, especially about the future. So... I'm going to take a lesson from Yogi Berra. I'm not going to make prediction, especially about the future. I don't know that this will happen. And that this would be that science comes up with knowledge and technology that democratizes enlightenment on this planet, makes it readily available to really large numbers of people. I don't know that that's going to happen. But what I can tell you is that I am definitely a professional meditation teacher, and I'm a pretty good scientist. And everything that I know about meditation and science tells me this could happen. It's not a ridiculous notion. Whether it will happen, as I say, that's a whole other question. Science, in other words, I'm a mestizo. I'm a half breed. I have two races in me, and they're completely mixed. One is the result of almost 50 years of traditional Buddhist practice. The other is the result of doing a lot of math and science and neuroscience and physics, and really tasting the power of science. And because they coexist in me as one thing, I can see how they could cooperate to come up with something radical, really radical. And I don't know what that something is. I just see how it, my gut tells me, I can feel it in my bones that it could happen based on everything I know about these two incredibly powerful disciplines. And that's basically what I have to say about that, which is sort of a happy thought, right? Yes.
I think I've had dots of it. Is the idea to eventually try to connect the dots? Is that better?
Yeah. Yeah, apparently you have to talk slow and bring it really close.
I think I've had dots of it in times of deep practice. Is the idea to connect the dots?
The dots being little tastes of no self, true self, etc. And the question was, is the idea to connect the dots? And I would say that's a great way to describe it. That is absolutely the idea. At some point, at first it's sort of sporadic, and then it's a little less sporadic, and at some point it's 24/7.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Never asked that before.
I think over here is, okay, I'll let someone decide.
This will be pretty quick. Some of this may be from past practice, but after lunch I seem to kind of get more with what you were suggesting we do. I believe I heard you say earlier that whether it's a visual picture inside or whether it's words, or whether it's sensory
body
sensations
sensation,
at the bodily
yeah.
level, that they all were equal. Maybe, again, I don't know if this is from what I was experiencing today or just because I have that history, but it does feel somehow significant that often the things, of course, that are in the head, I don't want to say aren't real, but it just seems like when I actually enter the body, that feels true in a way that the other things that are going on internally and mentally aren't. Or does that not matter? I mean, you know what I'm saying? I feel
I absolutely know what you're saying.
Yes.
There's a lot to say about that. Did everyone hear it? Okay. So what I said was slightly different. What I said was, with this technique, we'll consider any of the above to be equal. Okay, so that's an important little codicil. With this particular way of working, there is no privileging of one of the senses versus the other. However, there may be other ways of working where you selectively attend to one versus the other, etc. Now, history has been claimed to be a dialectical process, okay? So it sort of turns to the right, then it turns to the left, then it goes up, then it goes down, okay? There's this back and forth in history. Broadly speaking, most human beings live in their thoughts and are somewhat estranged from their bodily experience. That is true, most human beings. So there is a natural tendency for people that get involved in spiritual practices or growth practices in general to have the notion, well, we got to get people out of their heads. And where are you when you're out of your head? Well, if you're still in yourself, then you're in your body, okay? However, you could also have the same anchoring effect that you get from body. You could have that by anchoring in sound. That would take you out of your head. Or you could anchor in sights. The first koan that I got from one of the Zen masters I studied with was, when you see the flower, how do you experience God? And then it's like, WTF, right? What the fuck is he talking about? And then it's like, okay, I see you can't get that. So here's another way. I'll give you the koan a different way. When you see the flower, how do you experience true love? Oh, you don't get that. Okay. When you see the flower, how do you become free from yourself? Well, guess what? These are all the same question, okay? They're all the same question. It's just the Zen poetry for you to eventually realize that they're the same question. Now, Zen is poetry. Vipassana, or mindfulness, is prose. I'm actually not a Zen teacher. I'm a mindfulness teacher, which allows me to explain stuff. instead of just energetically pointing, which also has its charm. Don't get me wrong. So what happens when you advert your gaze towards something? What happens sensorially? Well, clearly, physical sight arises. Does anything else arise? Well, maybe. Maybe a mental comment about what you're looking at, or maybe a body emotion, or maybe a visual mental association, or maybe two, or maybe all three might occur. Now, let's say that you decide that you're going to just see out, and you're going to let that just be in the background. Well, at some point, that reactivity will die away, and you would have the experience of freedom from self, not by going into the body, but by going into an external sight. So if you want, so one reason that people tend to privilege body, so I said history, right? So most human beings are estranged from their body. So then people on a growth or spiritual path sort of go in the other direction. And it's suddenly, if it's not the body, it's not real. It's like bending over too far the other way and missing the big picture about what's really going on with the senses. One of the things that's helpful with the body is it's anchoring, okay? But you could just as well get out of your head by focusing on external sights and external sounds.
Isn't there more chance of delusion when you're with sight, all the associations, all the like and discomfort, the feeling? I'm not even talking about pain, but when we get in the body, we notice this tingling, this aliveness, or whatever. It's indisputable. Is that the right word? Yes.
Yeah, I understand. This is a long answer that I'm not going to give, because you're actually now raising several other interesting and important issues. But I'm going to say that with respect to getting out of your head, with enough concentration power, you could do that with sight and sound just as well. Now, the problem with the mind is not the mind. The problem with the mind is that it is surrounded by so much habitual unconsciousness and stickiness. Now, it's true that if you focus on the body intensely enough, the mind will first go into peacefulness, and then at some point it'll just work through its own stickiness. So that could work as a strategy. However, the same thing could happen with sight or sound, in theory. However, there's another way to think about the whole thing, which is the issue is not thought. Thought is not the problem. What the problem is the habitual unconsciousness and stickiness that surrounds the thought. That's the problem. So it's of the utmost importance not to demonize the sensory event of thinking and making that a problem. Thinking is a problem, but it's because of the unconsciousness and coagulation. Now, one way to work through that unconsciousness and coagulation is focus on something else intently enough that it just sort of takes care of itself eventually. That's one way. However, there's a whole other way, which is you could turn your attention towards the mind, give it complete permission to expand and contract as it wants, it constantly infuse it with clarity and equanimity. I will tell you that your mind, from this instant to the instant you die, your mind will at any given instant be in exactly one of four states. You'll either have some level of mental image, and it might be very subtle, but you eventually could learn to detect that.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.